Hello, everyone, and welcome to Teach Me Teacher, a podcast for educators, where we, the teachers, become students ourselves. I'm your host, Jacob Chastain, and today we'll be learning about mindfulness in the classroom for everyone who needs it. Just to get right into things, I don't want to give a big intro about this because there's a lot to cover if we want to talk about what mindfulness is and how it's applicable to certain things. And I think it's an important topic, and I think it lends itself to a deeper conversation. So without further ado, I want to introduce one of my favorite mentors of all time, Miss Stacy Hammer, who used to, she taught me all the way back in high school twice. Her pleasure.
Indeed.
And then, I had the pleasure of working with her right out of college in my first job at RMS, where I'm still at. So welcome, Stacy Hammer.
Hi, Jacob.
How are you doing?
I'm doing so well.
Yes.
I'm honored to be a part of this.
I am so glad to have you on this podcast, just because you are an infinite, everyone that knows you knows that you're an infinite well of knowledge.
Oh.
Yes.
I like that symbol.
Yeah. Put it on your resume.
That's
whatever
right.
Job you're
infinite
doing.
Infinite well. That's me. Well of something.
Yeah. Well, and that hopefully we'll find out what's in there in that well today. So for those of you who didn't look at the title of this podcast, this is about mindfulness today. We're talking about really what this is. I know it's a buzzword, right? I mean, anyone who's watched Oprah or seen Oprah on the news anywhere has heard the term mindfulness somewhere. She's kind of spearheaded it into almost the zeitgeist.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And she, you know, a lot of people hear it, and there's a lot of books out there. You can go to New Age sections in the store.
Yeah,
you can go to
don't.
Self-help. Yeah, please don't. But, you know, they're everywhere, right? They're Walmart shelves, mindfulness. So before we get to that,
okay,
I want to ask you, what is your... Give us some of your background so we know where you're coming from, and tell us kind of where this mindfulness practice came from in regards to where you're at timeline-wise in your career.
So for me personally, before I was a teacher, I didn't step into the classroom as a teacher until I was 35 years old. And so prior to that time, I worked extensively with youth and college students in a church setting. I think that I've always been motivated to take people to a deeper, more reflective place. And so because of my upbringing, the most obvious choice for that was originally in the church. And then over some time, it evolved into kind of a sense of calling into public education, which obviously forced a change in the content of those conversations. But
sure.
As an English teacher, I was also afforded an ability to go a little deeper with students and get them to question, you know, why they're here. Still that resonant theme was getting students to really think, getting the people that I had influence over and that I got to serve to really question their purpose. And so what's interesting is that this kind of lends itself very nicely to this concept of meditation or mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
One of the interesting things about me being in the classroom was at some point in the last 15 years, with updates in technology, we've been able to see the brain friendliness of what I guess some people would call prayer, other people would call meditation. Doctors would just simply call a quiet moment or
mm-hmm.
being in the present. But that there's an actual physiological benefit to these practices. For some, they also bear like a spiritual practice. But in school, I remember when we would study philosophy and we would talk about how over time literature was the product of people asking these existential questions. And this is really one of my joys in working with other people is to get them to ask those bigger questions. And so once I left the classroom 5 years ago now, I began working with teachers, and I found that that common thread followed me for my 4 years as an academic coach, because you quickly find that there are people who were born to be in the classroom. And there are people who would be happier and more fulfilled doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're not taking the time to be still, be aware, and realistically assess your place in the world, you can wind up literally sacrificing your life and time to something that isn't even fulfilling you, much less bringing any joy or depth to the students that you have contact with. So now as an assistant principal, I'm working again with students, and I get to work with teachers, and I'm still working on the ability to monitor my own time and make sure that I'm present enough to have a balance where I still can do those things that give me that great joy, and also take care of the many other things that are begging for my attention at all times.
So when you were kind of going through, you know, your career, at what point, if there was an actual point, did you stop and kind of reassess and go, I need to know why I'm doing this, or I need to like get in touch with a deeper level? Like, when did this mindfulness or this deeper level of analyzing yourself come about? Was it always there, or did it just strike?
It absolutely was always there. I think that there are semantic differences in the way that I would describe it based on my surroundings. But at the end of the day, what I now know to be true is that all of these things were linked in that we all have a brain, and we all need our brain to be healthy. And so whatever your version of that is, the reason why so many different walks of life or so many different faith brands or whatever you want to say have this commonality of a time of quiet, a time of stilling your mind, now we know is neuroscientifically healthy for us as human beings. And so I'm only retrospectively able to see that there was a commonality. But yes, I've always, I mean, from a very, very young age, essentially been pulled to these deeper, more philosophical truths, if you will. And like you said, mindfulness is on trend right now. But I really think that it's a good word because it gets us away from kind of the messiness that can come with attaching some religion to it or something like that. Not to take away from anybody's practice, but working in public education, that part of the conversation kind of makes it messy. And we'll get into what I really feel called to do with this, but is the one thing that I know is going to have to be stepped out very cautiously when I present the idea that, you know, students could benefit from these practices, because we are a public school. We are a tax-funded institution. We are not a parochial, you know, you and I don't work in a parochial situation.
Sure.
And so we don't have the liberty, or we don't have the even agenda to try to convert students to some version of faith. We really just want to answer for a lot of the dilemmas we face as public educators.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of that is, it rings true for anyone who's even half kind of looked into this, because there are, you know, there's studies upon studies. I'm going to put some of these links on the website, but, you know, where they talk about how mindfulness, you know, to help rehabilitate, you know, prisoners, you know, not to draw the equivalency between school children and prisoners, but just that it can literally change people's lives if, you know, conducted in a successful and healthy way. But before we jump all the way to how it can help students and all that, I really want to know what mindfulness is. When you say mindfulness,
yes,
what are you talking about? How are we approaching this today?
Okay, so I'm going to talk about the state of mindfulness rather than the practice of mindfulness first.
Okay.
Because the state of mindfulness just means bringing your thoughts to the present. Being aware of this moment and allowing any future or past connections in your brain to float on down the river of consciousness. I know that sounds so ooey-gooey, but all it really means is, where am I now? What's actually happening right now? It's a state of being awake to the present.
And which, you know, that's not to cut you off, but being in like the present, like that's a weird phrase because it seems so obvious. Like, at, when I remember when I first heard it, and they were like, you know, be present, be here now, right? It was, you know, you take a step back, and then when you finally do, when you finally are here now, it's a weird opening almost inside of your brain. And that's the best way I can describe it. Because mm-hmm. you're like, oh, where was I before this? Mm-hmm. And then I guess that's where that stream of consciousness, you're just traveling, you're flowing with your thoughts rather than being a rock in the river, I guess. Is that how you would describe it?
Yes. And it's really important to insert here that the purpose or really the benefits of this state of being is the whole reason that this appeals to me. Mm-hmm. Because questions that came to my mind as I began to delve into this are, I'm in a very future-oriented industry. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to create goals. We have to have those goals and always be looking to those goals in order for our current, you know, steps to align to those goals. We've got to reflect on the past and what didn't work so that we can, you know, more adequately, you know, make plans for the future. And it's not about never, ever having future-oriented goals or never, ever reflecting. It's about training your mind to not stay over-attached to the past or the future so that you're missing out on the only moment that actually exists, mm-hmm. which is right now. And it goes back to brain health. I mean, this is probably going to come up a million times in this conversation.
Good.
Because what's going on in your brain when you're overly attached to regrets about the past or disappointments about the past, or even cherishing some version of yourself from the past, you know, some moment of success, or vice versa, you know, being so concerned about what's going to happen in the future that we aren't really living, hearing, we're not really listening, we're not really in some aspects living. And our brain loses, you know, if we don't continue to build the neural pathways to do so, it loses the capacity to retain the information that's coming at us right now. Our brain loses the capacity to control our impulses or our emotions in reactions to things because of these over attachments to the past and to the future.
Mm-hmm.
It actually came over with you brought up Oprah.
Yeah.
And that makes me think of the first time that I heard this phrasing concerning these practices was the guy that's attributed that bringing it over to Western civilization. His name is Jon Kabat-Zinn.
Yes.
And he, you know, he was initially the reason why medical doctors began to utilize mindfulness in their, you know, in their psychology sessions. Or in sessions with people with chronic pain and things like this. And so the medical profession has largely, you know, embraced this, you know, secularized version of being still,
mm-hmm.
training the mind. And then schools now have begun to see its benefits as well.
There's a lot of things to digest with that. But I mean, well, and I mean, it's such a big topic, which yes. is why I wanted to get right into it, just because it really does deserve the time for you to ponder over it. And anyone who's unfamiliar with these terms, it does help to kind of retalk.
Yeah, let's unpack them.
And unpack these things. So when we say mindfulness, you know, as far as you said it, you know, you're talking about the practice of mindfulness, which is being in the present.
So we talked about the state of it. I didn't actually get to the practice just yet.
Okay, so let's go get to that before we circle back.
Just as in any curricula that one would adopt in order to teach others, mm-hmm. it is very important that you first have some personal experience with it and that you actually know your content.
Yes.
As educators, we do know the difference between teaching a lesson that we really know that very little about,
yeah.
or a lesson about a content that we richly love and, you know, have a broad depth of knowledge in.
Sure.
And so that is really the reason why right now my focus is on my own personal practice, because by the time I'm actually talking to teachers about this and potentially parents so that students can get involved as well, I want to fully know and have explored the practice of mindfulness.
Mm-hmm.
The research is out there. The state of mindfulness is preferred. It is brain healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So the practice is what we actually have to kind of get down to the nitty gritty about, because there are practices of mindfulness that are deeply spiritual and meditative and, you know, reach back into ancient cultures. My mindfulness practice involves me sitting very still for 10 to 15 minutes, becoming really aware of my physicality, bringing my thoughts captive so that I'm here. Breath is typically a really good focal point because we all do it if mm-hmm. we're living. And it's just it's a nice way. If you're focusing on your breath, it's very difficult to trail off. So for me, I've learned that I cannot look at my phone.
Yeah.
And check email sure. or social media.
So do you put it away somewhere? News.
When I first get up and the alarm goes off, I have to go straight to... I even have a room in my house, a place that I don't do anything else but that, just so that it's, so that I don't have attachments to, oh, I need to clean this or oh, I need to do the laundry. It is mm-hmm. just a space that is dedicated to me being still. That just helps me. It's
right.
not, it's not absolutely necessary. People, you know, practice mindfulness at work or, you know, anywhere else. And I guess when I get back on contract, I'll see if that works for me as well. But it's a 10 to 15 minute period of time where I am exercising the muscle of my brain to be fully aware in the moment.
Exercise. That's kind of, I was thinking that when you're speaking, so I'm glad you brought it up. But it's almost, that's what it sounds like, because we know exercise is good for us. That doesn't mean we all do it, right? We know eating, you know.
Those of you that can't see the both of us, it's very true. We don't.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's what, you know, and you, when you do it, you're like, oh, this is great. Mm-hmm. You know, you hate it in the moment, but afterwards you're accomplished and whatnot.
Sure.
You know, eating healthy, same kind of thing. Drinking healthy, same type of thing. So mindfulness, it's almost like, it seems like, because we live in our heads every day, you know, all day. All we know is ourselves, really. You're trapped in there all day. I can never be inside your head. You can never be inside mine. We're just alone in there, you know, with all of our little thoughts and whatever else we have in there. So you're sitting there all day. It's easy to overlook that that's where you're at. You're not...
Well, and it's easy to not ever really be there as well.
Yeah, which is odd.
That Jon Kabat-Zinn guy that I was talking about, he's famously known to ask people who he's talking to about mindfulness or introducing the concept to just do some homework. And the homework is simply, the next time you're taking a shower, ask yourself, are you in the shower or not? And it's a really interesting thing. So now every time, you know, I'm taking a shower, I'm thinking, you know, am I here? Am I feeling the water on my face? Am I taking this moment? Or am I, you know, zooming through my schedule for the day? Am I, you know, thinking through conversations that didn't go quite as I wanted them to in the past? You know, it's just a really simple kind of spot check for how able we are to be here now.
Yeah. And you have, and I don't know, that's a really good point, because you're sitting there, and I mean, how I think about it all the time, but you're in there and you're worried about the fears of whatever is coming. You know, it doesn't have to be like massive fears, but like, you know, you have to get this done or whatever. And one thing I've known about what I've tried to practice mindfulness in the brief times I've experimented with it, if that could be the proper word, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you sit there and then somehow you convince yourself this isn't as important as whatever you have to do in 10 minutes. Or at sure. least that's the case for me. And I'll be like, you know what? I can be here mindfulness and this is awesome, but, you know, I got to go feed the dog. Or like you start thinking of the chores that you wouldn't do normally that you would try to put off.
That's right.
It's like you want to get out of your head.
Well, so what you're speaking to now goes back to the concept of it's a muscle that you're training. I've even come to believe that some of my mindfulness sessions or whatever that are what I might judge as least successful, because it's just for whatever reason, yesterday was a day like this where I could not make my mind still.
Mm-hmm.
I would be thinking about the breath and then immediately my mind was on something else. Yeah. And it was like wrestling. And I have a really hard time still with letting go of judgments about it. Like, oh, I am sucking at this today. Why can't I just, you know what I mean? Like,
you're sitting there in self-loathing for 15 minutes.
Well, it's, you know, I've always wanted to be a perfect student, right? So, but I've almost come to the realization that days in which my practice is really difficult are some of the most productive. Because here's the benefit of actually being able to do this and becoming a more mindful person outside of some sort of formal practice like my morning rituals. You know, when I'm talking to people, I mean, people are the most important part of my job, right? Mm-hmm. As an educator. When I'm talking to people, if I can be more quick to be aware of when I'm not fully listening, when I'm not fully hearing them, rather than letting it get away from me, the quicker I am to go, oh, wait, I missed that last thing. But I'm also more authentically communicating how important they are to me. I mean, this is just one thing that as we become so wired, you know, we are multiply wired at all times with our mm-hmm. computer screens in front of us and one if not two devices on either side and maybe the TV screen going and then maybe there's other chaos or whatever. We have become so good at not being fully present with one thing. And that's for us adults.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Who have the wherewithal and the life experience to realize that these things are important. Right?
Yeah.
Imagine how much more important it is to preventatively teach students how to do that, who we are raising in a world of Web 2.0 and are constantly connected.
Yeah, and
to
you
so
have
many things.
And, yeah, and anyone who's been in a classroom sees it pretty much at all ages. But here's the thing that, you know, I'm always looking to the future. I'm like, what new things can I do?
Absolutely.
How can technology augment what I'm doing?
And humble to boot.
Yeah. Totally. But I feel like I'm comfortable in that state.
Sure.
Problem is that it does put me at a state of conflicting opinions because there's times where I want to use technology and put all this stuff into my room and really get the kids involved in their technology and be able to use it well. But at the same time, I know that hurts them in some ways because they get that all the time anyway. They are constantly connected. They're playing games. They're on their phones. They're doing all this other stuff. So when you get them to sit down to work on something or get them to sit down to read or just be quiet and not move, it's extremely challenging for a bigger majority of them.
Well, their brains are absolutely biologically not wired to do so.
Yeah.
It's not a non-compliance issue.
Sure.
It's not... I mean, this is one of the hardest things, and there's 22 of them and one of you,
mm-hmm.
To remind yourself that for most of them, this is not a willful thing. This is an inability to do what we're asking because their minds have been wired differently than ours are. And unless we adopt some way of intentionally rebuilding those neural pathways, we're going to continue to be so frustrated that they can't just focus and be what we like to say on task.
Yeah.
And we can be master lesson designers. We can plan the most engaging, cooperative, socio-constructivist, give me some more education lingo. I mean, we can be that and still be frustrated when our students don't have the capacity to attend to the task we've given them long enough to get to any real critical thought.
Sure.
You know, past some cursory understanding of what it is that you're saying, miss, or in your case, mister, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
But knowing these things about the way their brains are wired and actually intentionally doing something about the way their brains are wired are two, you know, points that I haven't seen meet very often.
Bring it a little bit into the classroom.
I've already gone there.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, it's fine.
You're in charge of this interview.
The guests are really in charge. We all know where the power lies. When you're talking about bringing kids to the present, I mean, any teacher listening to this right now or administrator, they're like, yes, please show me how to get the students to sit. Or, you know, because it's, you know, I talk to a lot of teachers, and the younger ones are generally like, you know, like myself, you know, we see them moving around, but it's not that weird to us. But if you talk to a teacher who's been in the game for a long time, a lot of them are not jaded from the experience, but a lot of them are like, these kids are wild, right? I mean, you hear it everywhere. You know, kids are too connected. They're ADD, you know, all this other stuff. And it's, and I guess, I mean, they are different, but how do we mesh the new practices we know with technology and really enriching the learning environment, while at the same time trying to bring in that ability to not always be connected.
Well, I think that for those of us who are paid by the taxpayers, the government has largely attempted to do this by bringing in high-stakes testing, right?
Yeah.
Because if we aren't successful in getting them to attend to the learning, we have a metric that shows that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's already pressure to ensure that the learning is happening at a place where it'll make us at least look successful. Even if our hearts aren't actually for the children,
mm-hmm.
we now have a metric that is designed to rank us in our success. And that's a totally different podcast. But I'm just saying, to your question, there are already attempts to make sure that people who are stuck in a mindset where it's the children's fault that they're not learning, are already either being coached away from that mindset or being coached out of the profession.
Mm-hmm.
And so I use the word coached very generously there. But the truth is, you do have to understand the differences between the brains of the students in front of you and your own particular learning style or success, or, you know, at a cellular level, your own ability to focus. But that's one of the many benefits of teaching a student from a very young age to be able to control their emotions and their consciousness.
Yeah.
Because that muscle gets stronger and stronger, and their capacity to know when, oh, right now I can't be looking at my phone. I have to have my phone away because it's distracting me from being able to be mindful about what the teacher is teaching me.
Yeah.
And that doesn't, it's not like this magic wand. It's not like, and then they're always able to focus from then on, but at least they have a tool. And the more they've been allowed to practice that tool, it becomes owned by them as something that then they actually have been empowered to make those decisions for themselves. Like, this isn't brain healthy for me right now. And they can even, I've even seen little elementary kids begin to use words like amygdala and prefrontal cortex and things like that, because they can visualize, oh no, this is what's happening. And so I've got to do X, Y, Z in order to even focus on what the teacher's saying.
That's a huge request to make of your students, right? To be able to think about not only how their brain's working, but on how to proactively problem solve if they find themselves in a different type of situation. But one thing that I try to do, I guess, in my class is I always ask, am I asking them to do something that I won't do? Or am I asking them to do something that is hard for adults? And I would say this falls into that category that most adults, I didn't say most, that's probably overgeneralization, but a lot of adults definitely have trouble stepping away to get where they need to be focused. I mean, you can see if you go to trainings, you go to a big seminar, mm-hmm. people have spent hundreds of dollars on this. You're sitting in front of the most brilliant minds. There are people in there playing games on their phones. They're sure. reading books on their iPads.
Well, and that's why, at least for me, right? Because all I have power over is my own choices.
Yeah.
The discipline of the practice has to begin with me. The discipline to record my own progress in this, my own reflections, revelations, whatever is happening as I'm trying to commit to this. That's why journaling it is so important, because I do want to model that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't ever want to ask, and you know, for me as an administrator, I don't ever want to ask my teacher something to do something that I'm not willing to do first, or that I'm not willing to train them to do. Right? It's reciprocal accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that I model that for my teachers, the more that then I hope and expect that they will model that for their students. Right.
Yeah.
So right now, you know, in the blogging that I'm doing, some of the things that I'm writing about are just simply personal reflection, honesty about commitments from here on out. Being careful to not judge, right?
Yeah.
That's a really important part of mindfulness, is that you don't get caught up in the regret or in the what ifs. The realistic assessment, formative assessment, if you will,
yeah.
to go back to educationese. what do you do with the data from a formative assessment? Right? When I pick mm-hmm. something up in my life, when I have a revelation or some sort of epiphany or whatever, because I've allowed my mind to get still, and that's when the best connections happen, right? Picking up something that comes to mind that I should have done differently and just accepting it for, wow, now I have that information, allows me to step into the future and the next moment where I'm present with a determination to do better.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
It's, what is it? Failure is feedback.
Sure.
It's something we like to say a lot when we're talking about the growth mindset. It's not about beating yourself up. It's about learning from it.
So how does this look with teachers? Because, you know, I think the obvious implications for students is it'll help them be able to problem solve, you know, the anger that they might be feeling that day, the anxiety, helping them stay focused, etc. Right?
I mean, yeah. Well, and let me, I keep wanting to speak to that, and I don't want to let it get away from me again. So one of the things is in my practice, because I'm no longer with you at the middle school level, I'm at the elementary school level.
Sure.
At this point. And one of the biggest ahas for me as I have begun working with students kindergarten through fifth grade, and if the parents hadn't already been aware enough to figure things out before they got to school, a mm-hmm. lot of the assessment is happening, you know, at the age level where I am sure. right now, the age level that I serve. They come to school, they can't acculturate or assimilate quick enough, something is wrong. Right? Why yeah. is the student unable to come into this institutionalized situation like other students are able to? And then you go through the lengthy process of having them tested, and then, you know, conversations about medication come up, et cetera, right? And I work on a Title I campus, which means a large, you know, portion of my families that I serve are socioeconomically struggling,
mm-hmm.
Which sometimes plays into their inability to either get medication or go to the doctor often enough for the dosage to be the correct, you know, dosage. And when a kindergartner, first grader, or second grader, when it becomes established that they are emotionally disturbed, we're talking about that sweet child that goes red every once in a while becomes a literal physical risk to everyone else in the room.
Yeah.
And it's a heartbreaking situation, but my office was completely destroyed. Furniture knocked down, chairs thrown, me punched, bitten, kicked multiple times this year as we desperately searched to figure out how do we support this kid's success.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, in my office, when a student comes to me, maybe not in rages, but just dealing enough with the uncontrollable emotions or lack of attention that they have that they cannot stay in the classroom, then I can remediate, right? The younger mm-hmm. they get, these mindful things look very, very different. So my counselor, you know, first taught me, because I'm, you know, I taught high school
yeah.
and then I was an administrator at a middle school. So when kindergartners and first graders are coming to me, I had to learn a whole different way of dealing with students, right?
Mm-hmm.
But my counselor taught me, you know, you have them hold their fists in front of their face, smell the roses. And all you're doing is tricking them into taking a deep breath, right?
Yeah.
Getting oxygen to their brain, right? And then the other strategy is you have 10 candles. Your fingers are all candles and you're just blowing them out. And it takes them time. And the crazy thing is, they will do it. Those little kids, they are smelling the roses. They are blowing out the candles, right?
That's awesome.
And you don't have to enter into some deep conversation about mindfulness. Now, mm-hmm. as they get a tiny bit older and you start talking to them about what's going on in their brain, when they, like at my, one of my fourth graders that, I mean, completely enthralled with the idea that he could figure out what was going on in his brain. But I was only working with him whenever he would land in my office. So yeah. we're not talking about anything preventative.
Sure.
Other than if they get to a place where they're mature enough, right? Which mm-hmm. in elementary school, psychologically, they may not be developed to that extent,
yeah.
right? Where they begin to see the triggers that are happening before they fly off the handle, and they can incorporate some of the little, you know, breathing strategies and things like that that you've taught them, right? So that's all remediation. But what I'm talking about and what research shows us is if these types of mindful breathing, mindful listening strategies are taught on a regular basis in a completely de-escalated, you know what I mean, classroom situation, then you're actually giving students those tools to utilize on the daily, not just in extreme situations where, especially when I was at the middle school level and I was only practicing these things or teaching these things, you know, to kids after they'd gotten in a fight or after they'd mouthed off to a teacher, you know, and they're just blowing up and they wind up in my office. It wore me down as a human being. The fact that I was seeing less and less hope that these intermittent conversations every once in a while when they got in that much trouble, that I was ever going to be able to teach them things that would actually make a difference in the real world. Mm-hmm. They were already adolescents. They lived in chaos. They came to school. Every little thing that happened to them, they were blowing up at, right? Mm-hmm. And then after the fact, after they've been dragged to the assistant principal's office, sure, then we're trying to retroactively go back and talk about when your triggers happen, what can you do, and things like this. It's too little, too late.
I know you're dealing with elementary school students, but what stage most commonly have you seen where they start developing that ability to, like, or not ability, but that excitement when you tell them, hey, this is what's happening in your brain. Like, do they get excited at, you know, in first grade, or is that a later thing? When does that start clicking?
Well, the excitement can happen depending on the personality of the child, but actual retention to move forward and remember that conversation even occurred and maybe transfer the skill that I taught them, mm-hmm, to a real life, you know, situation in a different context. If everything in a child's life has gone normally to where their psychological development is following the normal curve,
yeah,
fourth grade. I had some advanced kids in third grade this year that were in my office quite a bit, that had just seen more of life, and they just, you know, as we say, had to grow up too soon, that were able to engage in these conversations with me.
So what's the conversation like before that? When they come in and they're not able to... Or when you're, you know, if you're talking about the brain and they're not connecting to it the way you want, what's that conversation look like?
Well, I have a couple of, I have some things in my office, and I got these ideas from a really cool assistant principal down in Austin, and he was one of the many little seeds of mindfulness along my journey before I decided to jump in. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I have is a little sand garden. Did you ever see it in my office at Richland Middle School?
Probably.
It's just a little 10 by 6 inch tray of sand with some rocks in it.
Yeah.
And then a couple of bamboo rakes that you can move the rocks around. And the idea behind having it on my desk is kids are fascinated because the sand is white and they think it's sugar or salt. They do not believe me that it is sand. They have no idea that when they walk into my office and they're still huffing, you know what I mean? They're still,
yeah,
red or crying. At the elementary school, there's a lot more crying.
Yeah.
And when they come into my office to try to engage their brain in any kind of conversation that's going to bring about behavioral transformation, that's silly. Mm-hmm. Because they haven't even calmed down to where, I mean, once you learn about the brain, you realize there are things that the brain cannot do when it's in that state. And one of those things is reflect on their actions.
Yeah.
And so when they come in, they can't help but pick up the rake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some of them just want to be left alone and they're so angry that they've completely shut down. That's different. Then I actually pick up the rake and I hand it to them and I say, hey, when you're ready, just start moving those rocks around. And there's something very alluring about the little sand garden that they cannot not do. And the trick that I was taught by the assistant principal in Austin that inspired me was when you notice that they're capable of making a straight line in the sand, that's when you know their brain is ready.
That's crazy.
Isn't it crazy?
Yeah.
And it's such a trick, too, because kids love sand and rocks.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
That's a neat toy.
Yeah.
And unless their parents are, like, really into, like, koi ponds and zen gardens, you know, they've never seen such a thing. And so, there are lures, as I would say, mm-hmm, in. I also have kinesthetic sand that I use for different purposes. Have you seen that sand that kind of molds It's a very interesting...
Like moon sand or something?
Yes, yes. And I guess they used to advertise in the 90s
or whatever.
It looks like it might be moist, but it's not moist, and you can actually
yeah
form it and stuff, and there's a very therapeutic aspect to it. Mm-hmm. I also have a chill-out corner in my office that's almost completely... I can see where they are, but they can be hidden from sight where they can calm down. They only get 3 minutes in there. They can't just... I'm not going to do history yeah today. I'm going to go sit in Miss Hammer's office. But I've designed my office to lead to these types of conversations.
Mm-hmm.
So that once their brain is ready to have some reflection time, some planning for the next time conversation, I've manipulated that. You know, I've manipulated the circumstances mm-hmm that would lead to those kinds of conversations.
How would a teacher do that? You have a, you know, your environment's a lot different than a classroom.
Absolutely. And how? It's less effective because I do not have the relationship with those students
sure
that the teacher has. And I do not have that daily ability to have the student do a spot check on where are you at?
Yeah.
How's your brain today? Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're asking how a teacher would do that with students who have rage issues.
Or just in general, how do you set up... What would be the things a teacher would want to set up in their classroom? I mean, you can't just have sand gardens everywhere or whatever. So it seems like the process would be a little bit different in a room. Or what type of steps a teacher would take to kind of de-escalate or mm-hmm control an environment before or hopefully prevent ever getting to your office.
Long before I was, quote unquote, into mindfulness, I taught English. And you may or may not remember that on Fridays, the lights would be lowered, and it was free writing. As a matter of fact, I would play Explosions in the Sky, Pandora Station. Because there's no lyrics.
Sure.
That's a brain-friendly thing, too. Yeah. That music without lyrics, you can zone out or get into that space more easily than mm-hmm if your brain is trying to make sense of a communique or a message in a song. And... even if you just doodled for 3 minutes, you free wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole concept for me was about, I know that there's a lot of drama in the hallways. I know that there may be a million things going on at home that you're just trying to process and make sense of or escape from or, you know, deal with. In this room, we've got to learn. So I've got to help transition you from life outside this room into a place where you can cultivate your voice in the world. Mm-hmm. Which is what I felt like my job was as an English teacher.
Yeah.
And so we couldn't do it every day because the curriculum demanded that we spend our time, you know, in other ways. But I found that on those Fridays where I took the time to intentionally set up that liminal space, that threshold in between, that I got so much better work out of students. And on Fridays, which was not easy because on Fridays, teenagers are already on the weekend in their mind.
Yeah.
Right? But so... switch that to the age that I am with now, okay? I'm bypassing middle school altogether, and I'm going to the elementary school environment. This year, we're instituting something called morning meetings, which is just a time, and it's going to look different for each teacher because each teacher deserves the ability to bring their own
yeah
person, right, into their learning community. But the morning meeting, the only non-negotiable is that the morning meeting be about each student being greeted as if it matters that they came that day and that that's how you start your day.
Mm-hmm.
So in my, you know, dream of all dreams, teachers who are on board with this, teachers who are like, hey, I like what you're doing and I'd like to see the effects in my classroom, right, would incorporate into their morning meeting just a moment or two of, okay, put your hand on your belly. Notice the air coming in, noticing the air going out. What kind of day do you want to have today? Training the kids to get their mind into a positive place before you even begin the busy agenda of all the things you have to teach them and all the things that you have to do that day. The data from schools that have been doing this for years shows not only a drastic reduction in bullying, because the humanity of other students comes out when you are intentional about these things.
So it's rules and procedures.
Yeah.
I mean, pretty much.
Yeah.
I mean, you set up your rules and procedures before you start content.
I did get to be your assistant principal for a year. You know very well that if you don't take the time to set up a culture of mutual respect and where we are here and we are present and we are kind, that you lose a lot of teaching time to the various immaturities.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I mean, my first year was filled with me fighting that, what you just said. Someone would make a quip or whatever, and I'm, you know, I have that personality, you know, and I'm just hanging out with people, I make quips and do all this stuff. So teaching, you know, 13-year-olds, 14-year-olds who have, you know, their humor is not 100% different from mine. It's closer than, you know, when you're dealing with sixth graders. I don't know what that says about me as a human.
It's an apt role for you.
Yeah, but there would be moments where, you know, I would get almost caught in just talking to them or saying things. But before you know it, you've derailed something. Kids eventually... You know, it's not bad once or twice, but eventually if you keep up that lack of barrier between you and them, what ends up happening is it deteriorates how they look at you. You know, going back to this, what you just said at the beginning is if I was putting it in my classroom, it would be me every day establishing these are the types of... This is like the feeling you get when you come into my classroom. We're going to... be respectful to each other. We're going to be thoughtful. We are going to try to be aware of where we are now. We're going to kind of check whatever just happened in the hallway at the door. Yes, there was a fight in the mixmaster of the hallway, but you're in here now, and this is a different world.
Well, and the reason why it's so important to wherever your kids are, whether they can write better or whether they can just think better, the reason why it's important to give them the moment to be alone with their own brain,
mm-hmm.
whether that's, like I said, in writing or just in thought, rather than just you saying it, is because it only works if they fully make that transition internally. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And so I think that's another reason that speaks to the importance of teachers practicing this themselves, is because it's one thing entirely to know the brain benefit for your kids, to want less or fewer behavioral disruptions and to want less bullying and more kindness between your students and things like this. It's another thing altogether to get your own brain to a healthy and focused place where you're able to be more intentional, to where you're able to actually hear them even though you've got 1,000 things to do. I mean, I've only begun to respect teachers more as I've gotten out of the classroom, because the task that we are asking you to do is impossible.
Yeah.
All that we've asked and all the new things every year that we add mm-hmm. to the plate. So the only way that a person underneath that much expectation can succeed is to get to a place of, here I am, I am present. These are the steps I'm going to take today, and I'm going to do the very best I can. And I'm not going to judge how I did. I'm going to do better tomorrow than I do today, but I'm not going to judge it. I'm going to look at it. I'm going to be aware. I'm going to take a formative assessment on my progress.
Yeah.
And then tomorrow I'm going to do the next thing. And that be your determination to stay in this moment, because then the connections you're making with your student, both socially, right, and academically, are more authentic. They're more, differentiated, you know. You can only be intentionally differentiating what you give each student if you've actually genuinely connected. But realistically assessing, you bring your own self. You bring your own insecurities as a human being. You bring your own ego as a human being into the classroom. And all of those things you're at risk of allowing to take away from the whole point of being in the classroom with those students if you're not brain healthy yourself.
When you're, you know, you're doing this in the summer, right?
Yeah.
And you talk about it on your blog, you know, right at the beginning. You're like, yeah, you know, am I cheating by starting now?
Gosh,
you know,
I hope not.
I think it's a good, I mean, yeah, hit the ground running somehow. And doing it at the beginning of the year would probably be terrible. But, so, you're doing it right in the summer. But when you go back to your team.
Yeah.
Are you bringing this to the teachers? Are you saying, hey, this is mindfulness. Like, what's going on? Like, with this, and I want this to connect just to the people listening and the teachers listening, because, you know, it's so easy to get caught in, how does this help my students? But we have to think of ourselves too. Right. We have a big job, and we have a stressful job, and we have 8 million things to get done, let alone, you know, worry about our mental health while we're in the classroom, while we're trying to teach someone what a verb is for the 900th time. So you have, what are you doing when you go back? Is you going to have a big meeting and say, hey guys, let's get Zen. You know, what's going on?
Well, it is really important that I state for the record that I am the assistant principal. I happily and cheerfully serve an amazing principal. Mm-hmm. And when I say these things, it's not my school. It's my principal's school, to be clear. But the plan at the moment, you know, unless it changes, because one of the things I'm really having to train my brain not to do right now is freak out about everything that you just said.
Yeah.
Is, you know, I've committed to writing every single day for a year, and I'm taking one day off.
And for your credit.
I'm taking Sundays off.
To your credit, I tried to talk to you about doing a podcast, and you were like, writing, talk to you later.
I'm trying to be very disciplined about my practice.
That's good.
Because ultimately, I do get the sense that I'm going to be talking to people about this. And so it's very important that I have attempted an implementation so I can see what, you know, so I'm not just reading about results other places, but I'm actually bringing effective change to our school. I mean, my heart breaks for our students who, and my own child is on ADD medication, so this is not a judgment of medication as a whole. It's not about never medicating, but at the elementary level, you see it firsthand how much we go to that conversation quickly, because our ability to give the student any other kind of consistent tools to train their brain requires a plan, mm-hmm. a plan that we don't have. We just know that we have 23, you know, kindergartners in a room. We absolutely have to be able to teach them their letters and their numbers, or they will not be successful in first grade. And if they are climbing the walls and pinging, literally pinging off of the other students, that is impossible.
Yeah.
Okay? So I understand why we are where we are, and I understand that one of the things I have a sense that I'm called to talk about or whatever will be the implementation of this. I feel like the plan of attempting this at my school is really important.
Mm-hmm.
So, at this point, one thing we've already agreed upon, we have a positive behavior intervention system committee on our campus, PBIS, and their sole purpose is to get together to really kind of problem solve for some of our campus-wide issues that we're seeing. And one of the things that we're introducing next year are these morning meetings. Some classes were already having them, just kind of a checkpoint in the morning before we start our day, right after announcements. It's very perfect. In elementary schools, it's not uncommon to have a little mat somewhere in the room where kids are used to gathering and sitting on the ground. I mean, mm-hmm. it's a different world from secondary, my yeah. background. And so they have the perfect situation to sit in a circle and have a check-in with students in the morning. So when we have our obligatory training for our circle-ups or morning meetings at the beginning of the year before the kids get back, my plan at this point is just to do a quick, hey, I'm practicing mindfulness. Here's some, you know, research on how it's brain healthy, and I think it might answer some of our problems. If any of you are kind of interested in exploring that with me, will you hang out after the training? And so that way it's a no pressure situation. It's just a way for a group of us who are like-minded and see the value in this can partner with the parents. Because you can't just enter into something like yeah. this without communicating with parents, sure. you know, and helping them understand what it is and what it isn't, getting the parents okay and on board with it, and then trying it out in their morning meetings and getting together a few times through the year and really talking about what we see of the benefits and how we could do it better and, you know, lessons learned and things like this. And then on top of that, we have both a guidance counselor, and we have a student assistance counselor that comes half a day once a week that meets with students who we would say are more challenged behaviorally or emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we would ramp up our efforts with those students to make sure that, that we're practicing these mindfulness tactics or strategies the once or twice a week that they're meeting with those counselors. And then being diligent to record whether there's something to this or not for us in our context. So that's the my year of mindfulness and education project for me. I have no idea where it will lead. I have a sense that it's kind of a culmination of everything I've been about my whole life.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes me really excited. But I also don't really want to overattach because I can't design the future. I can just do me today.
You've experimented with this a little bit, at least from what I could tell from your blog. Y'all took a test, and you kind of had, I think if I remember correctly, you had all the students in the cafeteria.
Okay.
Or what? Yeah, I want you to explain it, but I just want to know, did you see, could you tell any type of change that happened? Anything that came from this?
Well, to be clear, the state gave the students a test, as you well know.
Sure.
So third, fourth, and fifth graders took their STAR tests.
Yeah.
And as I was meeting with teachers, I wanted to meet with all testing students and just really talk about getting their mind in a healthy place before the test. So my original intention was actually just to go and speak to the students.
Mm-hmm.
Each homeroom that was about to take their STAR reading and math tests. But as I was preparing, because I had this cute little technology thing I was going to do with them, and we were going to get them all pumped up, and you know that's something you see quite often is where you get kids like amped up for the test. You can do it, yes,
yes.
You know, it's like a Rocky theme, and you know, and the closer I got, the more. You know, we have a lot of students with test anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
It just occurred to me that rather than give them some big pump you up speech,
mm-hmm.
that I was going to take it down a notch because here we were 2 days before the test. If they didn't know their stuff by then, you know, it was time to just let it go
mm-hmm.
and trust that they were prepared. You know, I told them, hey, if you feel comfortable, close your eyes just so you won't get distracted. If you don't, then just look at the ground right in front of you or whatever. And I have them really think about relaxing the muscles in their head, in their neck. It's called a body scan.
Mm-hmm.
And some kids were sitting on desks and some kids were sitting on the floor, and it was not like a collective consciousness situation. You know, I want to be clear about that. And then afterwards, just really ask them to talk about how they felt, talk about how this could be useful for them during a test. Ask them to make connections to other times when it might be useful. And that's really when you hear it, you know, from kids. You know, when my parents are fighting and I'm in my room and I can hear them.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me stressed and this is something I could do. I mean, I think that was really kind of the concretizing of how powerful this could be if I didn't just fly in 2 days before the test and say, hey, here's a strategy. Go for it, right? But if it was something that was actually intentionally planned as a socio-emotional skill set
mm-hmm.
that we tasked ourselves with giving students that really can carry them through life. When I was younger and all I had in my pocket was the body scanning because my theater teacher in high school would have us lay on the ground before performances and body scan so we were very, very aware of our physicality and the physicality we brought to the stage. And she mentioned that it was really helpful also for letting yourself fall asleep and turning your mind off at night, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I really struggled with that. Still do sometimes. Just your mind continuing and not going to sleep for hours after you're laying still, right?
Yeah.
And so there have been times sporadically through my entire life where I've done the body scan thing, right? And just kind of allowed my muscles to relax until I could go to sleep.
Did you see a change?
Well,
the students?
This is the thing. I didn't even check. And that's just me being really honest with you.
Yeah.
I mean, this is the reason why I'm committed to a daily discipline of writing about my year in mindfulness is because I know myself well enough to know if there's not some arbitrary external structure, the follow-through aspect of good ideas for me isn't my strength, right? It's why I need a team so much around me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone who is type A and who goes, you have a meeting at 5.
Yeah.
Don't forget it. or this deadline is, you know, passed, things like that. So if I'm doing something personally, there has to be some trick to hold me accountable to it.
So this actually leads directly into my final question, which is, why are you doing this live? You know, you mentioned briefly, you know, it's to kind of keep you on track, but mm-hmm. is that the only reason that you're blogging and putting yourself out there? Because it does take, I mean, you are, you know, there's a vulnerability aspect to any time you put something public out there, you know, and it's not, and it's a little bit more detailed than that. I mean, you share personal information on your blog, you know, just kind of in the little snippets of, you know, here and there. So why put yourself through that? Why put yourself through this process of, you know, creating something for people to consume?
First and foremost, I made the commitment to writing about it, to blogging about it, and making it public, because I know myself well enough to know that there's not a social component to any commitment I make. I tend to talk myself out of it.
Mm-hmm.
After the idea and the novelty of it is worn off and I'm no longer pumped about it, yeah. Things tend to go away. So I just felt like that was a strategic move mm-hmm. for me. The benefits and the residual purposes for it continue to emerge. And so one of the things that I'm already aware of is... writing is something I've always felt like I was supposed to be doing, but the paralyzing fear of judgment or lack of qualifications or, I mean, all of these just perceived reasons to not put my voice out there,
mm-hmm.
right? Always kept me from doing so. And I had a pretty pivotal conversation, one of many that actually led me to diving into this year-long commitment with my principals, about a month ago now, where it was our very last contract day together, and we had just gotten through with this great little conference where we had been learning, and we were about to not see each other for the summer, and I let her know I wasn't really that excited about the summer. I'm not necessarily good with downtime. It's like I don't know what to do with myself.
Preaching to the choir.
Yeah. And so... I mean, I was really thankful for the time off. Don't get me wrong. It's not like I wanted, you know, the frenzy of the school year to be back in session. I was just revealing to her that I was a little nervous, you know, about so much idle time. And she said, well, what are your hobbies? And I came to the realization I have never, ever had hobbies as an adult. None. My husband always has a hobby. And by hobby, I mean... an obsession that's actually more important than his work. and we've been married for 24 years, and so, you know, he definitely has something he's very interested in. I wish it was my interest as well. It is not. I have tried. My interest has always been, my whole identity has always been wrapped up in what I do
mm-hmm.
instead of who I am, if I can say that.
Yeah.
So... my principal said, well, you're a great communicator. Why don't you write? And my response, without even thinking, was, well, I don't have my PhD yet. I haven't ever been a principal yet. Who would even read what I wrote?
Yeah.
And so I heard myself and how ridiculous that sounded and how, I don't know if it was falsely humble or it didn't ring true with me. Because... even if no one else ever reads a thing I write, the writing is really for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as an English teacher, I would always say, writing is thinking. I don't know what's going on inside your head until you get it out on the paper, and then I can help you with your thinking. But right now, I don't even know what you're thinking, because it's inside,
yeah.
right? And so I understood at that moment that writing was, that was a very important conversation. It was a watershed moment. And so I committed to writing, and then the knowledge that I would need to have some sort of commitment that people would hold me to in order to actually do it. And then there's always, I think in everything I've ever done, long before I was an educator, even when I was a teen, I think I've always had kind of a yearning for whatever I'm putting my hand to be significant for helping others.
Mm-hmm.
And... for a long time, I judged that about myself as being narcissistic or some negative version of self-advocacy. But at 45, I think I'm finally coming to the place where it's like, I am who I am. So why don't I just be really, really good at who I am?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to require discipline. Writing every day increases your skill set because it's a discipline. Communicating with others in a way that may or may not affect them for the better is something that it's okay to try and fail at or try and succeed at.
I mean, a lot of that is kind of where I come from as well, just because everything I do, I'm always like, how can I put this out there? Like, my parents used to make me perform on the drums as a child. So it's just always in me to perform.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why how I always think of everything. And it's not like, you know, I don't feel like I'm on stage or something like that. But it's always like, okay, so, you know, I like teaching and stuff. So I'm gonna make a podcast. Or I like, you know, reading books. So how can I talk about books in the public space? You know, it's always... Anyone who knows me knows that I'm not afraid to share an opinion, but it doesn't come from me thinking I am, you know, I think everyone should listen to me and understand me and I'm this brilliant human being. It comes from me just wanting to share and be connected in that way. And so it's almost like I don't have that hobby thing you mentioned. I was like, you know what? I have hobbies, I guess, but it's always in the back of my mind. I'm always like, how can I put this out there?
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, that's the origin of this podcast, which, you know, I was like, I have these great conversations with educators all the time. Why, you know, let's record them and, you know, get this focus thing. So it just hit home. I just wanted to say that. But anyway, I want to be mindful, of your time here. We are cutting a little bit close. I know you have a prior engagement, but I want to thank everyone for listening to this episode. I think this is... You know, I say this every episode, but I think it's just a super amazing episode. I think a lot of people can get a lot of this. So thank you, Hammer, for coming up and talking with me about mindfulness. I really do think it's going to help everyone. For everyone listening, this has been Teach Me Teacher. Go to teachmeteacherpodcast.com. Leave your comments on the episode. Let me know what you're doing. Give some feedback. Tell us how this episode has helped you. And remember, share this episode with your team. Have a good one.